Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard the Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Transcription for this podcast is brought to you by HarperTranscriptions.com. If you have any transcription needs, please head on over to our website. And if you mention this podcast, They Had to Go Out, your first transcription will be for free. Stay salty, my friends.
One to check out is the Always Ready Collective, delivering art by and for daring fighters of the sea with their maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. Visit them on Facebook, Etsy, Instagram, and at alwaysreadycollective.com. Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Had to Go Out podcast. Thanks everybody for joining us. Thanks for listening, subscribing, sharing, giving those five-star reviews, and doing everything you can to get the word out about the podcast. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, everybody, thanks. And if it's your first time here, welcome. We're glad you found us. You've probably got a lot of free time on your hands right now, so go back and listen to all the old episodes too. Give us a five-star review, like Phil said. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, anywhere, any social media platform. We're available there. We want to hear from you. We want to know what you'd like to see, and move on from that.
Twitter and YouTube. And hey, if you didn't know, I do have a co-host on this show. He's finally back from the West Coast, and where he was has been quarantined, all kinds of crazy stuff going on. But we got Bill back with us. He's healthy, and he's alive.
I was never sick, but the Coast Guard's abundance of caution told me I had to stay home for 2 weeks.
You got that sweet looking mask on right now, so we're practicing social distancing here.
Yeah, if you guys could see it, I have a very Mad Max-esque mask that I made because I can't sew very well.
Yeah. It looks terrible.
It's atrocious.
It really is.
It's absolutely atrocious.
All right, guys. Who we got today? Mr. Rick Koontz, born in New York, joined the Coast Guard back in 1972 with Bravo Company or Recruit Company Bravo 85 out of Cape May. Went from there to the Great Lakes Naval Training Center, where he became an engineman at A School. And from there to Group Buffalo, which further tasked him out to Station Galoo Island, which I have never heard of. I'm excited to hear about Galoo.
I was today years old when I learned that was a place.
Right. And then Station Oswego, ended up rounding out his career there and got out in 1976. Went into cars after that, volunteer fire service, and is now working for Ford in government sales, selling all kinds of police interceptors, fire trucks, all the cool stuff.
The cool toys.
That make a difference out there. And since 2002, he's been a member of the Coast Guard Auxiliary with Flotilla 214 out in Brewerton, New York. So with that, Rick, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
Excellent. Excited that you're joining us today on this this quarantine thing we got going on.
Are we going to have number the episodes? Like there's episode number and then a quarantine episode number?
Yeah, the coronavirus series.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. But we hope you and your family are staying healthy. And again, we're really, really happy that we have you with us.
Right. So really, I think there's two questions, really, Rick. One, are there any tigers involved in your story?
Are there any tigers?
Do you know? Have you seen Tiger King on New York Netflix yet?
It's the
no.
Okay, so you got to watch it at some point.
Yeah, and two, welcome. And what's your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
Well, you know, the most dangerous was because we were stupid. leaving Sackett's Harbor on a 40-footer when we should have been on a 44, because we heard of a boat in distress by Chemeau Bay. We were in for supplies. And the 44 did get underway, and they did handle the call, and we did get back to the island, but we did get an instructive talking to by Bosun Mate Chief Anthony J. Tombalillo, the officer in charge.
I like how you put
we decided to use better judgment from there on out.
And where were you at? What station were you at when this when these were happening?
This was Galoo Island.
Galoo Island. Tell us about Galoo Island.
Yeah.
No, but I don't think anyone. I don't know anything about Galoo Island.
Well, the Galoo Island is in the east end of Lake Ontario. It's just outside of the St. Lawrence River, and it had been there since 1920 something is, I think, when they built it. I'll tell you, it was one of the nicest places I've ever been. It's an island. It's about 5 miles wide, they're 5 miles long, 2 miles wide. One end we had a lighthouse, which is one of the oldest lighthouses on the lake. And at the other end is we had the station. We had, two boats there. We had a 40 and a 44. We would maintain the lighthouse, keep it fueled. We were pretty much self-sufficient. It was almost like being underway, except it didn't move.
No port calls.
No seasickness at all until you got on the 44, and then you were too scared to be sick. One of the biggest challenges was fueling the station and the light, because we'd have, at that time, was the Coast Guard cutter Maple would come out. We would take a fuel barge out with the 40, offload fuel from the Maple, bring it in, transfer it to the storage tanks at the station. From there, we'd put it in tank trailers. We had a Dodge pickup, four-wheel drive Dodge pickup, that we would tow the trailer to the other end of the island to the lighthouse to fuel the light.
That is a lot of effort.
Some classic Coast Guard right there.
Yeah, it is, right?
Really is. Yeah,
there's no way we could have improved that.
What's the most complex way we can accomplish this task?
Yeah, that pretty much. Of course, with all the modern technology we did have, when you stood your radio watch at night, what you'd have to do is, we had a sound-powered phone in the radio room. And the sound-powered phone, you'd lift up and listen to see if the fog signal was on. When the marine forecast came through and they told us to turn the fog signal on, I think it was three cranks to turn the fog signal on and two cranks to turn it off. And the only way you could monitor it is you'd have to go out on the front porch or listen out the back window of the radio room. Kind of neat.
Nobody manned the lighthouse 24/7. You guys just like kind of watched it from the station comm center?
Right. It used to be manned 24/7, 365. They used to have a crew down there. But when they put in the SAR station, I think it was like in the mid-1950s, they made it a semi-automated light. They hooked up, and by semi-automated, it means they hooked up a sound-powered phone to it and sent everybody else home. And we'd go down two or three times a week. I think it was like Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. We'd go down to service the generator.
On relief days. You did it on relief days. Of course you had to do it on relief days.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there was no relief. We were out there for 3 weeks and off for one.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah, that just changed the whole dynamic of this thing. So you guys had to get transported out by 41, I guess, or by the Maple?
40. I'm a post 36 foot, pre 41 foot Coast Guard guy. Never been on a 36, never been on a 41.
Were the 40s wood holes?
No, I'm a little younger than that. They were steel.
Okay. I think that there were some 40s.
Yeah, there were a few wood 40s.
Yeah, right. What did they what were they powered by?
2671 Detroits.
Get them moving. Yeah, get them moving.
They were a fantastic, phenomenal boat. I mean, they were the backbone for years and years and years in the Coast Guard. The 44, which was relatively new at the time, that was the safest boat I think I've ever been. I wouldn't be afraid to do anything in the 44. It's just that safe of a boat. And, you know, we'd gone out in some pretty harrowing weather. You know, people don't think of the Great Lakes as being like the ocean, but I'll tell you, sometimes it's worse than the ocean because the distance between the waves is not quite what you get out in the open sea.
Yeah, inches.
So you
sometimes
can get beat up pretty good.
Oh, yeah. I think the on level of painful, it's Great Lakes, Gulf of Mexico, Atlantic, and then Pacific. That's my opinion.
I think I'd agree with that, having sailed on all of them. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Great Lakes will destroy you in quick order.
They will hurt you bad and quick.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much life on Glue Island. You know, you'd be out there, you'd be out there for 3 weeks. You get off for one. So what we would do is we would, instead of being out there for 21 days, we'd stay out for 22, take six off, put one in the bank. So at the end of the season, you know, for every cycle we were out there, we'd pick up a day of free leave at the end of the year.
Mm. Got it. Smart.
You just put it in the bank a little bit. It was kind of.
You say the season. What was the season? Was it seasonal? Like you did summertime stays out there.
Yeah, May, late, mid-April till they said, you better come in. It looks like it's going to freeze.
Right. Because not going to be able to get you, right? Or resupply. Yeah, man, that creates a whole slew of problems.
Something like that. Yeah, but it was a great place to be. The person that owned the island was a retired chief. His name was Charles Fitzpatrick, and he had a ranch out there on the island, and a huge garden. There was an airstrip on the island, kind of rugged airstrip, but airstrip nonetheless. And he was like the greatest landlord in the world. I mean, it was a phenomenal place to be. But with the advent of VHF and high-level sites, they were able to bridge that communication between the mouth of the St. Lawrence and Oswego. And when they did that, they automated the light, and that was the end of as Glue Island as a operational station.
Hmm.
It was kind of sad. I was the last guy, literally the last guy off the island.
That's cool.
Yeah, that is
That's
cool.
That's really cool.
Yeah, you were it.
Yeah.
Huh?
Did you guys?
Yeah,
go ahead, Rick.
Yeah, I was the last guy off. I got on the in Oswego. They had an 82-footer to cutter point steel, and everything else was gone. Point steel come out, picked up the remaining crew, and we went back in and never to go out again till 2000 and. I think it was 2001. We had a reunion, and we all went out to the island in September.
That's also
That's
cool.
Really
yeah,
cool.
That is cool that you guys went back out.
Did you leave any mementos on the island? I've been on some old lighthouses that used to be manned, and they'd paint like murals and stuff before they left. Did you guys do anything like that?
No, not we didn't. There was really nothing down at the actual lighthouse building itself. It was a gorgeous building. I mean, the architecture, the the entire lighthouse and the light building was built by limestone that was quarried on the island itself. So the architecture was phenomenal. The only thing I noticed about it, the ceilings were a little low, but they built it back in the 1800s when people were shorter, I guess.
Right.
Rick, tell us about, I want to hear about you being an engineman. So I think you're the first engineman I've ever talked to. And you went to the Great Lakes Training Center. What was the job of an engineman?
Well, at Galoo Island, it was literally everything. We had anything that that made noise, stunk, and leaked oil was our domain. We had an old Leroy four-cylinder hand crank engine for the windlass in the boathouse, and that was up to us to keep up and running. Maintenance on the boats, whatever they needed. We did have a little 40-horse Merc on a 16-footer that was out to the island. That they called that our
morale boat.
Yep. Which we would, you know, you take it out, go fishing and stuff. I mean, we would do that. The station's generators, we had to take care of the station's water treatment plant, because what we would do is we would draw water from Lake Ontario through filters into a water treatment plant. We have to maintain that. The furnaces, the two station main generators, and the two generators at the lighthouse, along with any other of the mechanical stuff that had to go with it. So that was all we had to do on the island.
That's all.
Yeah, that was it, huh?
It's just, you know, if you've got nothing else to do, you might as well fix something.
Right.
And, of course, the station's pickup truck, which everybody used to go out and try and see if they could break just to give us something to do.
Drive it like a rental, right?
Oh, yep.
yep, he knows.
Let's see how high we can jump this one-ton Dodge pickup truck in the air.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds
see if we can get a little air here. But, you know, primarily that back then, enginemen were, this was before machinery technicians, you know. It's interesting because I came in, I had the six-digit service number, and, you know, wore the old uniform, was called an engineman, and by the time I got out, we were using the social security number. I had a whole new uniform, and I was a machinery technician.
What were the changes in the uniforms?
Well, we went to the new style that you guys wear now. Before, we had the old Navy style.
Oh, like you had the old the cap.
You
like
went
the,
from the Navy to the what we called the gas station attendant uniform.
Yeah, we called it gas station uniform.
Yep. Absolutely. Okay. You know, I actually my combination cap that I wore in the active duty, I converted it over for the auxiliary. A lot of guys don't realize that that's a 40-year-old hat that I wear.
Oh wow,
that's cool.
And you know, with all those changes, it was during that period of time when there were a lot of things that changed for everybody. I mean, we used to go out on the 44, and it was a foul weather jacket, and you know, put some gloves on maybe, and you know, keep your PFD close by in case you needed it. You know, go on, get out there, get after it. And nowadays, I go to the station, and the changes now are so dramatic, where you know, they suit up, they get to put first, they put their ballistic vest on, then they put their PFD on over their ballistic vest, and they got the guns, and they got to clear the weapons and check this, check that, go out there, get on the boat. You know, it's such a difference. I mean, I feel privileged that I'm still able to go to the station that I finished my active duty on and work there and see what's going on now, and help and be part of it. I mean, it's just a phenomenal. It's an education. It really is.
I totally thought you were going to say it's such a privilege to have lived in a time when there were no rules. That's what I thought was coming out.
I had to laugh. I saw the All Coast message that came out the other day, relaxing the grooming standards for your hair, And I says, hey, they're going back to the 70s because we all look like a bunch of junglemen out there on the island.
I'm just waiting for the facial hair one to come out.
Yeah, as soon as the beard one comes out, we're gold.
I'm waiting on the beard.
Anyhow, we had some serious beard action going on back in the early 70s.
Were there any regulations against beards? Like at the time, did you have to keep it trimmed or anything?
Were there regulations?
Yeah.
Yeah, there was regulations, and then there was regulations.
And then there was Galoo Island, is what you're saying. Right?
Yeah, and we were a little different. I must say, my whole introduction to the place was I went to Sector Buffalo on a Sunday night. Monday morning, I went into the group engineer's office, and it was a warrant officer's name was Jack Champagne. The interesting thing about Jack is about 6 or 8 months, or summer before, actually, I worked for a local backhoe company, dump truck and backhoe, and I actually dug out around the foundation of the farmhouse he was restoring. So I actually knew him, and when I walked into his office, and I saw who it was, and he's chief warrant officer, and I'm a, fireman right out of engineering school going, oh, no, what have I got myself into? And I walk in, I see who it is. I look at him, and the first thing I said is, oh, blank. I says, I hope the basement doesn't leak. And he just looked at me and laughed. And he had the option of sending me out on the Ojibwa, which was a 110-foot ice-breaking tug in Buffalo, and I think he just teased me with that one, or sending me to Galoo Island, where he knew I couldn't get in too much trouble, because he actually was from my neighborhood, and so he told me to be on the dock in Sackett's Harbor at 0900 the next day, and I'm there, okay, well, let's see, it's 9:30 in the morning in Buffalo, I'm wearing my whites, and I never, ever, ever had to pay for a drink when I was wearing my whites. Got in my car, headed back home because I lived I lived about an hour away from Sackett's Harbor. Stopped in at the local pub, enjoyed myself for a few hours. I got a ride up there the next morning, and the young lady that brought me up said, I got to get back, dropped me off at the dock and left. And I was standing there, and there was no boats, there was nothing, and I'm going, I'm pretty sure that I goofed up here, until I heard that the 40 coming around the point. So the boat pulls up, and I throw my gear on there, and I say hi to everybody, and a gentleman steps out of the cabin, and he was wearing a chambray shirt and some Seafarers. And smiled at me. He says, "Hi, how you doing?" I says, "Hi, how you doing?" I says, and I always made a glib remark. He says, "Hey, who's running this McHale's Navy?" He says, "Oh, by the way, I'm your engine in chief, Bruce Cowell. I'll be your boss out here." And that's how we first met.
Nice.
So he reaches in and he pulls out a khaki combination cap, and I go, "Okay, well, I'm just getting right off at the right foot now." Remember, I've been in these whites now for a little over 24 hours, and plus I spent most of the evening at a bar. And we got out to the island where I first met Chief Tom Bellillo. As I walked into the station, I was maybe a little disheveled, needed a shave. He just took one look at me and pointed to where my quarters were going to be, and he says, "I'll see you after you get cleaned up."
Yeah, never good when you report in your dress uniform and you're not cleaned up.
So, but on the same token, though, I came down. He turned out to be absolutely one of my most respected, one of the best people I ever met in the Coast Guard. He was just a phenomenal person. He passed away about 4 years ago. He lived in Oswego when he retired. He lived in Oswego, when I went up for the funeral, even though I was in the auxiliary, the station asked if I wanted to to fall in with the station when they at the funeral and everything, and it was something that I'll never forget for the rest of my life.
Very cool.
He was that kind of guy. They loved him at the station. He actually came out of boot camp. His first duty station as a seaman apprentice was Coast Guard Station Oswego. When he retired as officer in charge of Coast Guard Station Oswego.
Yeah, that's a cool way to round
that's
it out.
That's a full circle right there.
Yeah, that was phenomenal.
We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 themed storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT. And how was Station Oswego when you were there? Like, so you said there's been a ton of changes between, I know, Galoo Island first, but you rounded it out at 2 years at Oswego, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. How did that, tell us about Oswego.
Oswego is a great place. It's a college town, number one. So there was
score.
There was no
a young man in uniform in a college town. Yeah, I see where this is going.
Wearing those whites around, I see why that was such a big part of the story.
There was no lack of outside entertainment.
Well, hey, Phil, you did notice Rick said he had a young lady drop him off at the dock after
that's his. The first thing I heard.
Yeah, that was well. You know, you got to get a ride. You know,
yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
So, and Oswego was. By the time I got to Oswego, Chief Tom Belillo had come from Galoo Island, and he was going to finish out his enlistment as the officer in charge of Station Oswego. So I went, I pretty much had the same officer in charge for 3 of the 4 years I was in, and who turned out to be a good friend. It was a very interesting interesting place. I mean, it was a little more in the public eye, so we had to be a little more, nowadays it's kind of public affairs. We kind of had to look like sailors and stuff.
So you had to get haircuts is what you're trying to say.
Yeah, but some of us, you know, the engineers, we didn't pay much attention to that.
Well, they still don't.
They really don't. Yeah, it's like it's an engineer thing.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, as long as there was coffee, then that's all we cared. But when I was at Oswego, we had a engine repair shop. We had parts. We had everything. We had a 3-bay garage that we kept our vehicles in. We had a rec room and a nice pool table. We had, you know, a crook that was there. And it was every day. It was 4 meals. It was just like on a ship. It was breakfast, lunch, dinner, and mid rats. They make sure we had mid rats. 24 hour radio watch. We were on a teletype network. We had a VHF high level site. So we could literally talk anywhere from Alex Bay to Erie, and we had a intercom system that was right when they came out with the Motorola high level systems that we could literally just push a button, and we had an intercom between all the stations in the sector. Well, it's sector now, but the group back then. So yeah, I mean, it kept you quite busy. It was 2-on-1-off. We would do all the maintenance on the boats. We had the 82-footer to Cutter Point Steel was tied up at Oswego, which was very interesting.
Why do you say interesting?
Well, because if you ever been to Oswego, it's a pretty tight little harbor. And if you go there now, they got finger piers out where the Point Steel was. It was it had about a 95-foot space to put an 82-foot
patrol. Plenty of room. Plenty of room.
They had one kid would come in there. Nobody would even talk to him. He'd just bring that boat in there, turn it around, lay it up there, and guys would just step off.
That's it. The engineer talking. You can tell. The engineer talking.
Yeah. They just do your thing, buddy, and
good.
Tell us what to do. And he was very good. They all were good, everybody that was there. We saw our we had a lot of fun. We did one, I think it was winter of 73, 74. We pulled the 40-footer in, 40586, up on the ways, and they wanted us to pull out the old high-hour engines, and they sent us brand new, remanufactured 671s, the gears and everything. So we literally took a winter, because it gets rather cold in Oswego, and we rebuilt that boat right down to all the seamen, the deck people, they literally stripped it. We were banging dents out of it from the inside. All new non-skid, cleaned the fuel tanks, painted out the bilges, put the new motors in. We had one of our reservists worked for a place called O'Donnell Quigley in Syracuse. They were the Detroit Detroit dealer, and he made those things just sing beautiful. Those are two of the sweetest motors we ever did, you know, and when they came down to sea trial it, and the engineers came from Buffalo, 6 months later, Buffalo took the boat.
Of course, yeah.
Shocking.
Typical.
It was brand new.
Yep,
right.
Typical.
Yeah. So we learned never to put that much work into anything again.
And that's the lesson.
Yep.
Don't work hard, kids.
Yeah. So, but nowadays, it's all, everything's under warranty. You go up there, the engineers, you know, they fix stuff and they do the checks and they do this, that, and the other thing. But they really don't do any hard mechanical work. It's, you know, they're capable. A lot of them are very capable of it. But they don't get to do the things we used to get to do, we used to have to do. Which is kind of sad, you know, to go through all that work, get all that knowledge and not be able to use it.
How many Coast Guard tools would you say you have in your garage, Rick?
Wait, what's the statute of limitations?
That's the big one now, right? Tool control. Like, yeah. we gotta maintain control of these tools.
I don't really have a lot of them because frankly, they weren't that good. I used to bring my stuff in from home. So there might have been a couple of sockets or a ratchet or something. But the biggest thing I took when I got out in 76 was a Coast Guard Reserve 30-footer. I took that home with me.
Wait, you took a whole boat?
Yeah.
Okay, I got to hear this story.
Yeah, how did that happen?
Back then it was civil defense. And the volunteer fire department that I was in, the South Bay Volunteer Fire Department, they had a couple of 30-footers in Oswego that were for the reserves. And they were decommissioning one of them. So through the civil defense, we were able to obtain, I think it was the 30430. I think that was the boat. And because I was intimately familiar with the boat, because that came under our purview up there as the engineers, because, you know, the regulars would use it as well as the reservists. When I left, I took my foul weather jacket with me and took the 30, and we took it back to Oneida Lake.
We
served there for 4 years.
Nice. What happened to her?
So, I'm actually looking for it. I hear it's someplace in Madison County in a barn.
It's funny how like people track, how we all track. Right. Coast. Yeah, it's crazy.
I know where there's a couple of 30s. I know where there's a couple of 40s. 140 that was at Rochester, the 40550, and that was stationed at Oswego. That moved from Oswego to Rochester when we closed Galoo Island. They sent our boat, the 586, to Oswego. They just moved everything down. But that boat is up on the Hard in SOTUS, and we've been trying to get that for 3 or 4 years for the Lighthouse Museum to maybe be able to get that, refurbish it, and, you know, if we could get it in the water, that'd be great. If we could, at least we'd have a static display.
What Lighthouse
Coast Guard
Museum,
boat that
right?
was stationed at Oswego. The Oswego Light.
Nice.
Oswego West Pierhead Light. That was another one I worked on because that came under our purview. We would we'd have to go out there, and we didn't have to fuel that light. The Army Corps of Engineers fueled it, but it was on shore power, so we just went out there to make sure the generators ran, make sure everything was serviced, everything. We go out there about once a week just to check it out, and basically we'd get bored and want to go out there and hang out at the lighthouse for a while because nobody bother us.
You don't even think about how many, you know, now where everything's automated, how often you guys had to visit the lighthouse just to keep it functioning. And this is even after when you say, like, they're semi-automated, right? I mean,
yeah. Well, this was pretty much fully automated. And it had a radio beacon out there, which we had to maintain the radio beacon. That was done from the watch room. But a lot of people don't even remember radio beacons and RDFs and all of that kind of stuff. I mean, you look at pictures of the older boats, and they used to have, you know, everything had an RDF loop on it. You look at them 10 years later, and the ones that had two big antennas now don't have any. You know, the two, I forget how many inch whips, and that was for the AM radios. Mm-hmm. They don't have them because they don't have AMs on them anymore. They're all VHF. So they have one little antenna stuck up there. They don't have a radio direction finding loop.
He's talking about 29 right now. I can tell.
No, I mean, we had them right up through the mid to late 70s.
Yeah, that's what I was just talking about. You know, the new, you're at Oswego now. They got 29 footers.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's worse. I don't know. Everybody,
the 29 footers are. Have you been on those?
Unfortunately,
quite a bit.
They're kind of caca.
Yeah. It's, I mean, would you take one? Would you take one of those things back to Oswego? You know, if you got to leave again, would you take the 29 with you, or would you just leave it there?
Oh, I'd leave it there.
Yeah, good man.
I'd leave it there because I could get an old Grumman canoe.
Right, call it a paddleboard, maybe.
Right. I did like the 25s.
Oh yeah,
everybody did.
Everybody liked 25s.
The 24. They've got for trailerable unit. That's a pretty good boat.
The shallow water.
And the 45 is just a blast.
Oh yeah, the 45 is crazy.
It's a spaceship. Yeah, it's like driving a spaceship.
Yeah, that's cool. I just have a hard time comparing them, you know, to the old 40s and the 44s, because they were just so analog. They were so simple. They were so basic, so dependable. You fall in love with them is what you do. And they're just a phenomenal, fantastic boat, the old ones. And the new ones are technological marvels. They're fantastic. That 45 is just an incredible boat. But I'm an old guy, so I like old stuff, I guess.
That's what, just a couple of them need like one less ECM, or, you know, maybe no need for an ECM, and we'd be good to go. I think that's what kills it. Yeah. Well, Rick, tell us
about all the electronics. Yep.
So you joined the auxiliary, what, 2 decades ago, give or take?
Yeah, it all came about in 2011. I was coming back to my very first reunion for Galoo Island. You know, they tracked me down and said, hey, we're having a reunion. You were out here. Come on back. So I said, okay. So, and the day I was supposed to leave San Francisco, I was living in San Francisco, was September 14th, 2001.
That was not a good travel day.
No, it wasn't. We all knew that our heads were spinning.
Oh yeah.
At that time, but I said, I'm not going to be deprived of this. I've been looking forward to it for 6 or 7 months. So I did finally. It was second flight that was wheels up from SFO, and I headed back east. I actually walked in the hotel in the middle of about 1 o'clock in the morning on that Friday night, and the reunion was Saturday and Sunday.
Okay.
And the guy looks at me like I'm from outer space. Nobody thought I was coming.
Right.
Neither did I. But and my luggage got there by the time I left too, so that was great.
Wow. That's impressive.
So when I walked into the reunion, the hospitality suite the next morning, it was, you know, everybody would just looked at me like I had three heads. And that was the first time we did go out to Galoo. They took us out, the Coast Guard Auxiliary took us out to the island, and we went on the island and stuff. So when I got back, I'm very, very pensive, okay, because I just relived my whole Coast Guard career, just a few simple months before. And my wife was looking in the San Francisco Examiner, my wife at the time, and she says, hey, look, it says the Coast Guard Auxiliary is augmenting the active duty Coast Guard, and they're looking for people to come and help. And I said, oh, cool. So it was off to Yerba Buena Island 2 weeks later. I walked in and sat at their first meeting. They says, well, what do you think? And I said, well, give me the paperwork. Let's go. I've been doing it ever since.
Cool. That's very cool.
What do you run boats for him or been in the air wing? What do you do for him, Rick?
Well, I started out because it was San Francisco. I started out doing communications for I think it's the Marine Safety Detachments now, or they've changed the name about 1,000 times. But the first thing they did was called the Sea Marshal Service.
Right.
Yep.
And I worked at Coast Guard Island, Alameda, doing communications and logistics for the Sea Marshal Service. So I literally would talk to the teams every 15 minutes when they were underway. I'd take them down to the pilot boat so they could go out. I'd go to the pier, pick them up when they came in. And I did that for several months. When I moved back to upstate New York, I got in the operations program, and because of my long history with the fire department and, my being in the auxiliary and being a Coast Guard veteran and stuff, I started working as a liaison between the first responders on the inland waters and the station, because it's a station Oswego is a two boat station with a station small and a summer stock, and they're still responsible for all the inland waters. So we work hand in hand with them, and I kind of brought the fire service, in which there's 6 or 7 boats on Oneida Lake, brought them in together and working with the Coast Guard, and we've been able to work pretty seamlessly. It's taken several years to get, you know, because volunteers are worse than engineers in the early 70s. They don't pay attention to nobody.
But not as bad as reservists.
and we've been able to
sort of
been there, done that. And we've been able to establish a great relationship, a great working relationship with the first responders. It's worked out real well for the Coast Guard. It's worked out real well for the first responders. They now have some good, realistic, real on the water training. The station helps provide them with that. They would provide with ice rescue training, support. We have a good communications between Sector Buffalo and the first responder units. Last summer, as a matter of fact, we had on Oneida Lake, we had two drownings within 22 hours, within 5 miles of each other.
Yeah, that's never
good. No, that was really, really bad. And I mean, all the education in the world wouldn't help these people, believe me. And one of the things that the station did is they called me. Of course, fire department called me. County Fire Control called me and asked me if I was available. So I went down, worked at the ICP, and I was the liaison between sector and the first responders, which left Station Oswego open to take care of Lake Ontario between halfway the other side of Sotus and Rochester, all the way up to Henderson Harbor, Sackett's Harbor area. Let them carry on their duties with their guys. So, I mean, it's been a long and a lot of work. I feel very fortunate that I'm able to do that. It's something I'm really passionate about.
Yeah, awesome way for to sure. continue serving. What would you give as a pitch for anyone that you know, could consider to join the auxiliary?
You're doing your commercial right now for the auxiliary.
Yeah, here's your auxiliary commercial. Let's hear it.
Here's my auxiliary commercial. Well, you can make a difference. You can reengage. You can really. We were, if you look at the numbers, and the numbers are the same as they were when you were in, there's less people in the U.S. Coast Guard, there is in the New York City Police Department. And we only have the world to cover. They just have New York City. If there's something you want to do, if you can do it, there's just so many different things, communications, operations. There's even a new food service program, which I'm also involved in that. I go up to the station a couple, three times a year, and I fill in for the cook. We feed the active duty. There's just a lot of pluses, and it is a volunteer organization, but there's something for everybody to do. If you just want to go back and relive your Coast Guard days, you ought to check it out. It's a good thing.
Very cool. I like the way that you kick that off with "you can make a difference." Also, I'll throw in a plug for the auxiliary. So I've seen auxiliaries run some phenomenal boats, like that, you know, are their own, right? But then the Coast Guard's paying them to go out there and cut holes in the water on occasion. Then other occasions respond to SAR and help save lives. I've been in planes funded, you know, with Coast Guard dollars to do first light searches and a couple other searches, and to support law enforcement operations, and to go into storms on occasion with an auxiliary pilot was a lot of fun. And the auxiliary cooks, what a deal.
Yeah,
like,
right
at the station, that was the best cook that we ever had. It was like we got rice and beans with the active duty cook, or we got the auxiliary cook who came in and made things happen. So if you can do the auxiliary, I think you do a huge benefit to the service, and you know, like Rick said, you definitely make a difference, and there's a huge personal payoff, I think, at the end of that.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I think the auxiliary is awesome. The times I've had to work with them, what a great asset, and to have those people that are all volunteering their time, and it's an awesome asset that I think we should all utilize more.
We had an ER doctor at Golden Gate, and if he happens to be out there listening, I would love to have him on the show. But he even used his time in the auxiliary to like help with a study, right? A study on blunt force trauma injuries and what they did to you. So tons of opportunity. Right. I mean, tons of opportunity to get involved in whatever you want to get involved in.
You learn things you can take back to your community, and the things that you've learned over your life, you can bring to the auxiliary and to the Coast Guard. And that is one of the biggest things that the active duty counts on us for, is our local knowledge. Because remember, if you're active duty, you're someplace 3 years and you're someplace else for a couple 3 years and you're someplace else for a couple of 3 years. But if you're in the auxiliary, this area, except for the 20-some years I was out in California, I've lived here all my life. I know where every rock in the bottom of that lake is because I probably found half of them.
that's why you're an engine man, not a bosun mate.
That's right. And this year we do have our own auxiliary boat that our members have actually worked on for 3 or 4 years to get it put together. So we'll be patrolling and taking even more weight off the active duty. They won't have to drag a boat down to an idle lake for something big and important. I mean, we'll be there on the water. So the opportunities are endless, and they're what you want it to be.
Best thing is you get to shoot the breeze with a bunch of really cool people, right? Like every day. That was kind of the coolest thing about the watchstanders. I got to just sit around and tell stories.
Well, I'll tell you, and I'll put in one plug for Oswego, for the station up there. Now we still have those reunions. We have them it's usually the second weekend in September every other year, so it's on the odd year. So it's next one will be 2021, and we have them at Oswego now. We used to have them at Sackett's Harbor, but I'm one of the very few Galoo Island people, so it started out for the Eastern Great Lakes guys that were up here in Lake Ontario, Lake Erie, that were in that sector, Buffalo area, and now it's pretty much everybody. We've got people coming from all over the country, and Coast Guard Station Oswego opens its doors and on Saturday, and we literally spend the entire day at the station, and I've never seen such a respectful, interested group of guys in my entire life. They treat everybody that walks in there, every one of the veterans, they treat them like solid gold. They treat them like a treasure, and that starts from the last kid that came through the gate that just got out of boot camp that scared to death, right on up to the officer in charge, which is now a senior chief, to the ETs, the engineers, everybody. They just treat everybody fantastically, and that's a good thing. I mean, I'm big on history, and I really love that respect that they give us.
No, yeah, Rick, and totally deserved. You guys laid the foundation for it, for what you guys did back then and well before you, I think, for over 200 years.
Just my quick math.
My quick
it's
math.
Like That's two,
my quick
230, math. I think.
I don't know.
Roughly.
So, it's not three yet. Right. So, we're still in there. Well, Rick, I'll let you – you got any parting shots for us?
No, I just want to thank you guys for reaching out and, letting me do this, because if there's one thing I love to do is I like to talk about the old guard, and I just got to remember that I'm part of the old guard, but when I was in, I was part of the new guard, and there used to be an old guard, and now the guys that are in now, and they're the old guard next time.
That's what I'm thinking, that you had that brand new 44, we got that brand new 45, God knows what it is next. Yeah. Hey, look at that brand new drone over there.
Right.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah, they won't let us play with drones yet on the auxiliary side, but it's coming.
Yeah, I wish it wouldn't come. I want to keep a job, you know.
Right.
It'd be cool if my son could drive a boat one day, but no, he'll be driving that Xbox controller even in service of his own country. That's all right.
That's kind of like why I love them old 40s and 44s.
Oh, I get it. It's kind of like servicing your car. I mean, these days you can't even service your car. You gotta take it in because it's too complex.
Complex, but I just love the memories and love to share them. Well, yeah. So anytime I got a couple other little rescues I could talk about, but some other time you want to reach out, I'd be more than happy to give you some facts and history of a couple of rescues in Oswego and one out on Galoo Island.
We'll take you up on that, Rick.
That sounds great. We'll do that sometime.
Yep. Hey, we appreciate your time. We appreciate your service, and we thank you for your service, Rick. And thanks for sharing your story with your audience today.
Thank you very much for reaching out. You guys have a great day.
You too. Stay safe.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform and like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.